Who is Tashfeen Malik today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. We still don't know much about the female suspect in the San Bernardino mass shootings, but there have been women jihadis before.
The other thing we see a lot of is that women will be the spark for radicalization.
One thing we do know about Malik is that she was from Pakistan, and that's troubling for many Pakistanis around the globe.
Just knowing that she was Pakistani, it instills fear in millions of Pakistanis.
Also, Brazil's political meltdown explained, southern India recovers from massive floods, and the Kenyan rapper who sings about everyone's business.
We all have something, and that is our business. Like, no one is born without business.
All that and more today on The World. More details are emerging today about the husband and wife accused of carrying out the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. There are reports that Syed Rizwan Farooq may have been in touch with Islamic extremists on social media. Sources have also told some media outlets that Farooq's wife, Tashfeen Malik, pledged allegiance to ISIS on her Facebook page. The FBI would not confirm those specifics, but the Bureau's director, James Comey, did go this far.
This is now a federal terrorism investigation led by the FBI. And the reason for that is that the investigation so far has developed indications of radicalization by the killers and of a potential inspiration by foreign terrorist organizations.
Earlier today, we called up Mia Bloom. She's a professor of communications at Georgia State University and the author of Dying to Kill. I asked her about what seems to be a very grim family affair.
We've seen lots of family connections to terror, whether it's the Sarnaya brothers or the Kouachi brothers or even the attack at the Bataclan.
Kouachi brothers who attacked Charlie Hebdo last January.
Exactly, and Tsarnaev, who attacked at the Boston Marathon. I think that the idea that terrorism is very much a family endeavor is borne true not just by the jihadi groups. We saw it with the Chechens. We saw it with many of these organizations, because making sure that someone doesn't change their mind at the last minute, there's no better way to do that than you don't disappoint a member of your family. But the other thing we see a lot of is not just that there's a family connection, but that women will be the spark for radicalization. So that whether it's the case here that Tashfeen is the one who radicalized Syed Farooq, we also have cases going back as far as 2005 where it was the woman who was the spark for radicalization and pushed the man into participating in the jihad. This is something that has been going on within the jihadi Salafi groups for a long time, and yet it still seems that it surprises many people, and it shouldn't.
How much can you tell us about what you know about the relationship and how it evolved between Syed Farooq and Tashfeen Malik?
Well, from what I've read, Syed Farooq, starting in around 2012, he was posting on various dating sites to find a spouse. And the way he described himself was, you know, he was devout, but modern and moderate. He was clearly well-adjusted, assimilated, successful, the American dream in every respect. But then when he went to Saudi Arabia in 2013, it appears that that's when he met Tashfeen, and that might be the beginning of his path into radicalization. But we don't know enough yet. Allegations are that there was an ISIS flag found in his garage, that there was actually more than 4,500 rounds of ammunition. It might have been as many as 6,000. And so the concern would be that the operation that was originally planned is not actually what they carried out. The concern would be that they were planning something much larger, but that when he went to the holiday party, he just snapped, went home, got the weapons, came back. The question for me would be, what was the actual original plan? Because what you have is 12 pipe bombs, thousands of rounds of ammunition, body armor. If he had been planning to attack the community center and the party in the first place, he would have brought the guns when he went there originally, not leaving the party, going to get the weapons and returning.
If it is the case that the woman radicalized a man, she would be surprised by that?
No, because we've seen it before. We saw it with the very first female suicide bomber for Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2005, a convert named Marielle de Gauque. She encouraged her husband to go to Iraq, and they took a Kia, loaded it with explosives, and killed several U.S. servicemen in Iraq. So we've seen women who are radical. We've also seen women who are more radical than their husbands.
Where have you seen women actually pushing back against their already radicalized husbands? Does that happen?
We do see that. For example, with the 9/11 bombers, we know that one of the bombers requested permission to go home because his wife was insisting that he come home, and he was really torn. But for the most part, there was always this assumption that having a wife, a child, a mortgage, you didn't have any time for terrorism. The jihadi groups have been quite clever. They've turned that idea on its head. So what they do is they match up men to women who are equally radical or equally committed to the cause, so that instead of having the wife and child as a mechanism of leaving the group, it's the anchor that makes sure that they don't leave.
So if this is the case, that in some way Tashfeen Malik radicalized her husband, does that represent a new reality that we're facing?
It's consistent with a reality we've seen. The jihadi groups, for example, in Indonesia, pairs a man with a radical woman to ensure that he doesn't leave the organization. So she is a bulwark against defection. This isn't something new. This is something very consistent with established patterns. And if you think about it, the idea that women are automatically a pacific or a mitigating influence, I think we've disproven that. We've seen women who are just as bloodthirsty as men. And so this idea that a woman can radicalize a man isn't something new. I think it's just, it runs counter to some of the conventional wisdoms and the pre-existing assumptions that we have that women are the kinder or the gentler sex. It's absolutely not the case.
Mia, final question. I know you're in Santa Barbara, California, for a conference on terrorism. What's been the conversation like there on the San Bernardino shootings?
Well, to be 100% frank, the conversation is that, you know, with the 355 mass casualty shootings this year in the United States, only two have been perpetrated by Muslims. And so the concern is that by overly focusing on this event versus other events, we are inadvertently playing into ISIS's hands. ISIS wants us to overreact. This idea of either refusing to let in refugees, that's exactly what ISIS wants. It's embarrassing for them that the refugees are trying to leave. They want us to overreact. They want us to treat the Muslim community as outsiders because that allows them to have their message ring true and resonate. All of these experts in the room, people who've been working on terrorism, cautioning, as we are academics and studying this phenomena, to be careful that we don't actually make ISIS's job easy for them by doing exactly what they want, which is overreacting.
I'm just curious to know also, Mia, what you make of the fact that they had a baby that they dropped off at her grandmother's house.
I think people instinctively are shocked by this, but if you remember in 2004, there was a female Palestinian suicide bomber, Reem Riashi, did the same thing. In fact, in her last will and testament and all the photos and the stills, you can see her holding the child. Hamas used this as an example in order to convey to the community that there are some things that are even more important than your child, which is the jihad.
All right, Mia Bloom, thank you very much. Mia Bloom, professor of communications at Georgia State University and author of Dying to Kill. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Both suspects in the attacks in San Bernardino have links to Pakistan. Syed Rizwan Farooq was the son of Pakistani immigrants, and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, she was born and lived in Pakistan. Bina Shah is a writer based in Karachi, often joins us on the show. She had a strong reaction when she learned that Tashfeen Malik was from her country. Bina Shah even wrote a posthumous letter to Malik online. Here's one quote. "If you committed your act of violence for any cause, you failed to achieve your goal, but you achieved a different one. You dragged your Pakistani sisters into the mud." Earlier today, Bina Shah told me that she feels like her entire country has been given a black eye.
Just knowing that she was Pakistani, just it instills fear in millions of Pakistanis, not just the ones living at home, but the ones that live in the United States and Europe and other parts of the world.
So that's what you meant by dragging all Pakistani women through the mud. I mean, what kind of what do you expect to be that backlash? What will it look like?
already we're seeing a backlash against Muslim women because many of them wear the hijab, the scarf over their heads, and that's the most easy way to identify them as Muslim. So they are actually incurring a high volume of abuse in the wake of the Paris attacks. And Muslim women, Pakistani women, are generally not known for perpetrating violence. They are actually more likely to be the victims of violence. This is just a very, very bad thing for all of us.
Do you think that kind of blowback you're describing occurs to attackers before they go out with their guns a-blazing? Again, we don't know what the motives were for Tashfeen Malik or Syed Farouk, but can you imagine that they are thinking before they stage an attack, this is going to come down harsh on Muslims, Muslim women?
They're not thinking. That's exactly the problem. That was the gist of my letter and the impetus of my anger. This was an extremely selfish, horrible thing to do. The violence and the taking of innocent lives is one thing. It's inexcusable. But the fact that Tashfeen Malik was a stranger to the United States, she didn't even live there. She came there on a fiancé visa. She came as a guest and an immigrant to the country. For her to abuse this kind of hospitality, for her to, you know, look the United States in the eye that invited her to come and make the United States her home, and for her to sort of thumb her nose at all of that and do this, it's just incomprehensible to me. And it's just going to make things so much more difficult for the millions of Pakistanis who want to make their home in the United States and live peacefully as good citizens.
And yet, Beena Shah, we hear from experts that extremists who stage attacks like this, it's precisely to bring pressure on the vast majority of people who are innocent, who are just want to get on with their lives.
Well, indeed. And up until this attack happened, Tashfeen Malik and her husband were those two innocents just wanting to get on with their lives. Her husband had a job. They had a baby. This sort of thing is very, it's baffling. So I think we do probably need to wait for more information before we can really say what happened.
In Karachi, though, what are Pakistanis there saying about the shooting in San Bernardino? Is it registering? Is it being reported?
Absolutely. Pakistanis, especially those who are on social media, and many of us have links to the United States either through relatives that live there or we've been there ourselves. I myself lived there and studied there. I have so many friends there. It's a mixture of disappointment and disgust. Like I said, this kind of violence, whether it occurs in Pakistan or whether it occurs in Paris or the United States, it just doesn't make sense to a lot of people.
And what are the media in Karachi saying about the shooting?
The media is not giving it too much prominence. So we have a lot going on at home already, so it's not taking up front pages of our newspapers. But there's just condemnation. There's no trying to justify this or excuse it or understand it in any way. It's just we send our condolences to the victims of the shooting in the United States as well.
Any sense that Pakistan's reputation has been harmed?
Well, our reputation on the political front, I don't think has been very high for a long time, ever since Osama bin Laden was caught and killed in our country. But for the average Pakistani American just wanting to live his or her life peacefully, normally in the United States, there was a lot of empathy and understanding. But what I fear is that patience is running out, time is running out, and with the presidential election and some of the terrible rhetoric that we've been seeing coming from some of the candidates, I think it's a confluence of some very bad factors, and I do feel fearful for what's going to happen next.
Beena Shah, a writer and columnist based in Karachi, Pakistan. Thank you as always, Beena.
Thank you.
Coming up later on the show, the story of a Jordanian kid whose life took a sharp turn toward ISIS and then into violence, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Impeachment proceedings have a way of slowing a country down, distracting it. And that's exactly what's happening in Brazil. The country's president, Dilma Rousseff, could be in serious trouble. Brazil's Congress launched impeachment proceedings against her earlier this week. Rousseff then appealed to the Supreme Court to stop it. But today, the court rejected her appeals. Will Carlos has been reporting the story for our partners at Global Post. He says Brazil is in for a long, drawn-out political fight.
We're right at the beginning of this process. You know, it's just gotten started. A committee will meet in the Congress that will last for at least several weeks. They then have to vote. There's a simple majority vote of that committee. It then goes to a full vote of the lower house of Congress and then to a full vote of the Senate. So there's a lot of steps to this. It's going to be a long time. Also, it's worth noting that most analysts think that she can survive this, think that President Rousseff can survive this. She has a majority in Congress. And, you know, most people don't think it's going to get very far.
But a lot of Rousseff's opponents are hoping the process will root out corruption within her administration, even if it doesn't lead directly to her. So far, news of the impeachment process has not had a huge impact on Brazil's precarious economy, and it looks like it will be stable in the short term.
But in the long term, if indeed she does end up getting impeached, I mean, that's not going to be good for Brazil, for the economy. And this is, Brazil is still one of the world's largest economies. It's gone through huge problems. It's in what many people are terming an actual depression now, not just a recession. Brazil's in really big trouble. And so it kind of needs all the help it can get. And the impeachment of its president in such dire economic times isn't good for Brazil and thus isn't good for the global economy.
Will Carlos there in Brazil. He's with our partners at Global Post. Let's turn now to a story out of Mexico. Recently, a priest was found murdered in Puebla State, a horrible incident that feels like a horrible trend in Mexico. Since 2013, 11 priests have been killed there. The World's Monica Campbell reports from the Mexican state of Guerrero.
Father Oscar Prudenciano Gonzalez begins his Sunday Mass with a blessing that'd be out of place in most parts of the world.
Decimos juntos, Señor Jesús, tú eres nuestra paz. Mira nuestra patria dañada por la violencia.
It's a blessing for the 20 or so people gathered at the front of the church. They're young and old, moms, sisters, dads. Many hold machetes and wear hiking boots.
Hoy precisamente van a iniciar una nueva búsqueda en algunos cerros de aquí de la ciudad.
Father Oscar says that today, these people will go dig in the hills, searching for relatives who've disappeared. Pray for them. He says he must offer his support.
Me pide aquí a la parroquia que si podría yo anunciar en las misas.
They asked me to talk about their searches, he says, so that others come out and look for their relatives too. But this simple blessing comes with a risk. We're in Guerrero, Mexico's most violent state, riddled with drug crime. And we're in the small city of Iguala, where 43 students vanished last year. Father Oscar knows his blessing and public solidarity with the families can put him in conflict with criminals.
Miedo siempre hemos tenido todos, ¿no? Pero la
necesidad, he says, fear, we all have that. But the needs of these people to find their loved ones, that's bigger than fear. But the threats against priests in Mexico are real. 11 have been killed here since 2012, making Mexico the most dangerous place for Catholic priests in the world. Omar Sotelo, a priest in Mexico City, tracks the violence.
La violencia que se ejerció contra ellos es extrema. La manera en como se ha ejercido el asesinato.
Many of the priest murders are unsolved, but he says they all have this in common: extreme violence, torture, kidnapping, high-powered guns, the signature of drug gangs. I ask Sotelo, why more deaths? What's changed? There's not a single answer, but he says the activist role that some priests play puts them on the front line.
Por defender a otras personas, principalmente migrantes, principalmente que no haya trasiego en los.
They're defending migrants. They're against drug trafficking, he says. And the priests know who's doing it. The criminals see that as a threat. And church leaders in Mexico, what are they doing? Sotelo says they've been quiet so far, at a loss maybe to confront the violence. But when Pope Francis comes to Mexico early next year, it's sure to be on the agenda. Back in Guerrero, Father Oscar knows the dangers. He's had a gun pointed at him, been caught in the crossfire of rival drug gangs.
Les han sacado dinero, a otros los han secuestrado.
He says other priests have been robbed, kidnapped, killed, so he takes precautions.
No salir también en la noche.
He doesn't go out after dark. He lets other priests know his whereabouts. He says it's a new chapter for priests in Mexico.
Bueno, había un respeto hacia el sacerdote. Hoy como que ese respeto se va perdiendo.
Respect for priests is being lost, he says. Now we're just like anyone else. At the same time, he can also find himself interacting intimately with the criminals themselves when they come to confession.
Un joven que venía, que él había matado gente.
He remembers one young man in a gang who said he'd killed people. He was filled with rage and regret.
Actuaste contra tu voluntad. ¿Por qué lo haces?
He tells these men not to kill. They say they're obligated. It's their job. So Father Oscar is in this precarious spot, wanting to help, listen to people from all sides of Mexico's troubles, from grieving parents to criminals.
¿Quién trae la varilla?
And for those up in the hills, digging for lost loved ones, the church gives them strength. Margarito Soriano is looking for his son, Mario, 38, who went missing 4 years ago.
Esa bendición, pues es pues la creencia de que Dios...
He says Father Oscar's blessing means God is with them, leading them by the hand as they search. Today, thanks to an anonymous tip, the group heads to a dense, thorny area. They see a spot where the dirt has been moved. They dig and find a single bone.
Está amarrado. Amarran a nuestros familiares de los pies.
There's rope around the bone, one of the men says. The person buried was tied up. The group puts dirt back over the site, marks it with a red flag, and hopes the authorities will follow up and identify the remains. Then the families pray. And they'll do it all again soon, meeting on Sundays at the church, shovels in hand, and a blessing before they go. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Iguala, Mexico.
And a bit later, a Kenyan rapper who is taking care of business and thinks we all should on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some say building more nuclear power plants would cut down on pollution, but would you want to live near one?
I do not lie awake worrying about a terrorist attacking a wind turbine. But you better worry about a terrorist attacking a nuclear reactor.
The Nuclear Power Scorecard, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In the next few minutes, a few stories about the planet's changing environment. We're going to start with a really dramatic story, and if you've seen the pictures, you know what I'm talking about. Southern India has been suffering through the region's heaviest rainfall in more than 100 years. Heavy rains in Chennai, used to be known as Madras, have left much of that city under several feet of water. More than 250 people have died, and thousands have been forced from their homes. My BBC colleague Sanjoy Majumdar is in Chennai. Sanjoy, what is the latest on the rains and these unprecedented floods?
Well, for about 36 hours, the rains began easing off after the intense showers the city experienced earlier in the week. Very, very heavy rainfall, the equivalent of a month's rain falling in the course of 2 days. But in the evening, we had some sharp showers again, very, very intense rain. I was out there for a brief while, and it was just belting down. And it happened really quickly, and then it stopped. And you really got a sense very much of how much this spell of rain has taken the city completely unawares. People I've been speaking to are just saying, you know, they've never seen anything like this. It just doesn't rain this much.
Yeah, I heard that today's rain that you were just describing was so intense that rescue helicopters couldn't even get off the ground.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when it starts raining like that, there's very little that anyone can do. I mean, I was looking down from a building when it started, and then all of a sudden, you know, the rain started coming down and you couldn't really see anything across anymore. And the road, it just literally took a few minutes for the road to be covered, completely covered in water, up to about ankle length.
I've seen pictures and heard descriptions saying the entire city has been underwater at one point or another. How accurate is that?
If you look at Chennai from the sky, or if you looked at Chennai from the sky, say, a day or two ago, what you'd have seen is a collection of little islands surrounded, all of them surrounded completely by water. And that's something that's just quite astonishing. This is, after all, India's fourth largest city. It's not just a big city, it's a manufacturing hub. Some of the world's biggest companies are based just outside Chennai, companies like Ford, like BMW. So this is a city which is actually quite well designed. And yet it's taken, you know, an intense shower to completely bring the city to a standstill. The international airport here, this is one of the busiest airports in the country. No flights have taken off for a couple of days because the runway is underwater. And I looked at a picture and you can actually see several aircraft on the tarmac, but you can't see the ground beneath them because all you can see is a big pool of water. And some of the smaller aircraft, private jets, were actually floating in the water.
So, Sanjoy, what has been the impact of all of this on people's lives in Chennai?
Well, a lot of people I've been speaking to, and particularly those who aren't very well off, have simply been devastated. Some of them have now begun going back home as the waters began receding. So for the first time, they were able to enter their homes, which were otherwise completely flooded. When the floods were at their most intense, there were neighborhoods where the water levels came right up to the first level of their homes. And so people had to climb up to the roofs if it was a single-story home. There are things like refrigerators and washing machines, television sets floating in the water, again, completely damaged. And it's worse in working class neighborhoods where people often have things that they used to work in. So if you're a tailor and you have a sewing machine, or if you're a small factory worker and you have a little machine inside your home, all of that is damaged.
Now, the Indian Army has been mobilized for rescue and relief operations. Are they actually picking people off their rooftops, kind of like we saw with Katrina?
They did that when the rain was at its most intense and there were a lot of people stranded. The Army and the Air Force used helicopters either to winch people off their roofs or to drop supplies until they could be rescued later. And a lot of the disaster relief teams used boats to get to people who were stuck. Something like 500 boats have been used over the past few days just to navigate through roads which are now waterways to try and get to neighborhoods deep inside which were completely surrounded by water.
And when they're not thinking about the water rising up to their ankles and knees around them, do people in Chennai also think about the climate change talks in Paris right now and how leaders may come up with a plan that would hopefully mitigate some of this flooding years down the road?
Interestingly, Prime Minister Modi, who was at Paris last week, actually made a reference to the fact that many parts of India are beginning to experience extreme weather patterns. And he said part of this was due to climate change. And then, of course, a week later, we have this. So, yes, there are people in India, in fact, not just in Chennai, who are beginning to worry about the fact that you are seeing, you know, extreme drought in one part of the country and then flooding probably around the same time in another part of the country. And they're hoping that, you know, that something can be done to address this.
My BBC colleague in Chennai, Sanjoy Majumdar, really appreciate your time.
Cheers.
All right, let's turn to the ongoing climate summit in Paris. Everybody there seems to be searching for a silver bullet, some kind of technological fix that produces clean energy, but which also lets economies grow. Some argue we already have part of the solution, nuclear energy. We just need more of it. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Climate scientist James Hansen is best known for sounding the alarm to Congress about the risks of global warming way back in 1988. Since then, he's been an outspoken critic on the lack of progress. He's doing that again this week in Paris. He spoke about his 8-year-old grandson, Connor. A few years ago, the boy overheard his famous grandpa talking about climate change and started crying.
So my wife quickly went to him and said, "Oh, don't worry, Connor. Grown-ups are working on this problem. They're going to solve the problem." Yeah, we should be solving the problem.
Hansen said his grandson is a bit older now and reached some conclusions like we can't build a time machine to fix the climate crisis.
And the other thing that he concluded was, you know, grown-ups are scared of nuclear power. But he says they should be scared of climate change.
For nuclear to make a dent on climate emissions, though, we'd better get busy building. To reduce greenhouse gases by 10 or 15% by mid-century, we might need to triple the amount of nuclear reactors worldwide. Building that much nuclear presents a big challenge.
It's expensive.
Kelly Sims Gallagher is at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
If you're an independent power producer and you're trying to decide what kind of power plant should I build, nuclear simply isn't competitive.
Nuclear plants cost between $10 and $12 billion to build. Atomic energy has other obvious knocks against it. Mary Lampert lives in the shadow of the Pilgrim nuclear power plant in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
My house is about 6 miles from the reactor across open water.
Lampert heads the community watchdog group Pilgrim Watch.
Believe me, I do not lie awake at night worrying about a terrorist attacking a wind turbine. But you better worry about a terrorist attacking a nuclear reactor.
She also worries about the possible health impacts from the plant and what to do with spent nuclear fuel.
What, are you worried of what's going to happen to a solar farm or a wind farm? when they're completed their time, what's going to happen to the waste? Well, not a big deal. Nuclear waste, poisonous for 250,000 years, and there's no place to put it.
Lampert makes a convincing argument and expresses concerns held by many people and nations. After the meltdown at the Fukushima plant in Japan, Germany said it was done with nuclear. Gunnar Luderer at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research says Germany and much of the developed world can reduce carbon emissions from electricity sources by 90 to 95% by mid-century without nuclear. He says we can get there by investing heavily in renewables and implementing smarter policies and building smarter grids. I asked him, how many wind turbines are we talking about building here?
Well, we can do the math. If you say, like, if half of those 1,000 gigawatts would be wind.
Now, not all wind turbines produce the same amount of electricity, but Luderer comes up with a figure for how many we'll need worldwide.
100,000 wind turbines per year, if I'm not mistaken.
100,000 wind turbines per year, that's 3.5 million by mid-century. To get a sense of perspective, there are less than one-tenth that many currently spinning their blades across the globe. And there are other big challenges to going all renewable, which is why some climate scientists are saying that renewables alone just can't get us where we need to be. Martin Malin at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government understands why people are frightened by nuclear power, and he understands that tripling the amount triples the risks. So I asked, is nuclear worth it?
What's worth it is to try and strengthen safety, strengthen security, address the proliferation problems, strengthen the institutions that regulate nuclear power. If we can do all that, it could make it possible for a more dramatic growth, and that is worthwhile. Over the long term, I think we're going to have to use this technology.
To get there, he says there needs to be a better dialogue between the public, industry, and governments. And Malin says people also need to understand the risks of continued reliance on dirtier energy sources like coal, risks beyond simply generating more greenhouse gases.
Something like 3 million people a year die prematurely from inhalation of fine particulates. Nothing like that number of people have died from nuclear accidents and, you know, radiation. So if you sort of compare those numbers, you think, well, you know, of course, you know, why wouldn't you want more nuclear?
Climate scientist James Hansen put things a bit more starkly in Paris this week.
We have to face the fact that this danger of fossil fuels is staring us in the face. It's absolutely 100% certain that we've got a very dangerous situation. And for us to say, oh, we're not going to use all the tools that we have to try to solve it is crazy.
Put another way, the world's policymakers need to decide which path forward is least crazy. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
And one more quick story about Paris, this one with a New England flavor. Yesterday was Young and Future Generations Day at the UN Climate Talks. Young delegates blew up balloons representing the Earth and held a die-in to call for stronger action. From Cape Cod, Heather Goldstone with our partners here at WGBH reports on one local high school student's unlikely journey to Paris.
It's 4:30 in the afternoon as a ferry pulls up to the dock in Woods Hole on Cape Cod. Sue Natalie is waiting for her son, Clancy, to get home from the charter high school he attends on nearby Martha's Vineyard.
Hi. How was your day?
It was good.
A 45-minute ferry ride may be an unusual commute for a 17-year-old high school junior, but it's nothing compared to the trip Clancy makes this week to the climate talks in Paris. It's an opportunity he earned in a contest his school held last summer.
Students would enter an essay, they'd be judged, and I was one of the 9 students that was chosen to go.
Clancy and his classmates had planned to take part in a huge climate march in Paris last weekend, but the protest and the school trip were both canceled after the terrorist attacks last month. Clancy was disappointed, but not deterred.
Now is almost safer than ever, because security is going to be tighter. I don't really have a fear about that.
Clancy is now the only student from his school traveling to Paris. He writes for a local paper, so he tried to get journalism credentials for the meeting. That didn't pan out, so he's just riding his mom's coattails. You see, Sue Natale is a climate scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center, where she studies what used to be the Arctic's permanently frozen ground.
There's a lot of carbon that's stored in permafrost, and as the permafrost thaws, microbes now can access that carbon, and they release it into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and methane.
Those are powerful greenhouse gases that could make climate change worse. Sue and Clancy are both mild-mannered and quiet-spoken, not the type to hype the dangers of climate change or badmouth policymakers. But both are frustrated by the attitudes of many American politicians toward climate action. Sue says she vacillates between frustration and optimism.
I'm optimistic that there'll be an agreement. I'm sure that agreement needs to be much stronger. But I do think it's important to have a starting point, and that's what I see this. I don't see this as the ending point. I see this as the starting point.
Clancy also sees his trip as a starting point on a different scale.
I want to see change happen. I want to see people curbing their emissions. I want to see how these things are done. And I want to see Paris as well.
Clancy will be documenting his experiences to share with his school. He's hoping that will influence fellow students on Martha's Vineyard.
If they see their peers or people their age are interested in this stuff and working on it, they'll get an interest too.
And Clancy says that's important.
The past generations, they've tried, but a lot of them have also messed things up. They've kind of put us into the situation. So this current generation needs to try and fix that.
As a scientist, Sue shies away from activism herself, but she's proud of her son and other student activists.
I worry about them, but I also have high expectations and high hopes for them that they are going to push this conversation forward.
That's something her own generation has largely failed to do so far. For The World, I'm Heather Goldstone on Cape Cod.
Before we take a break, a quick look ahead to a story we'll have for you on Monday. Say you're in France and you want to buy a French flag, the tricolor. Just call up a flag store.
Bonjour. Suite à une demande très importante de drapeau, notre standard n'est plus disponible.
The recording says there's an overwhelming number of flag orders, so our switchboard is no longer taking calls. Since the Paris attack, seems like everyone in France wants to fly the flag. French patriotism on the rise. That's coming up on Monday. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's go back to our top story today. The FBI says it's now officially investigating the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, as an act of terrorism. There have been unconfirmed reports that the couple involved in the attacks may have been in touch with or pledged allegiance to Islamic extremist groups. Our next story takes us to a place that's trying to stop that kind of radicalization. I'm talking about Jordan. Tamer El-Gobashi is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, and he's been following the story.
Jordan is nestled right next to Iraq and Syria. They share large borders with both countries, which are, as you know, are undergoing major troubles with the presence of Islamic State in Syria in addition to Iraq. In fact, the biggest border Jordan shares with Iraq is right up against Anbar province in Iraq, where Islamic State has a pretty significant presence in the provincial capital of Ramadi. In Jordan itself, you have a great deal of the Jordanian population very much supporting the monarchy there. Traditionally, it's been a quite popular monarchy. And especially these days, when the threat of complete societal and political breakdown is right on the border, and even far-flung places like Libya, citizens are looking at this and saying, well, we'd rather have a pretty repressive regime than complete civil war or all-out fighting in the streets. So there is a great deal of support for Jordanian anti-terrorism policies. However, there is a significant portion of the population that becomes victimized by such terror policies.
So the Jordanians who are crossing the border and joining extremist groups, what is it about them that makes them drawn to that ideology and the aims of ISIS or anybody else?
Well, you talk to Jordanian officials, you talk to family members of these people who have gone, you talk to maybe terrorism analysts and researchers, and they say they run the gamut of age. Typically, they're male, so there isn't a lot of female, a lot of women joining these groups. But typically, they're men. But they've, as we've seen in recent cases, they come from the type of social and economic background that you would expect someone to who would be willing to become a suicide bomber or enter a place where there's extraordinary danger, poverty. There's a high unemployment among youth there. But in recent cases, we've seen at least two young men one joined the Nusra Front in Syria and another joined Islamic State in Iraq. Both of them were sons of the political elite. Both of their fathers were members of parliament. And keep in mind, parliament in Jordan is very much a rubber stamp parliament. It's not a parliament with any real opposition. So when we talk about MPs, we're talking about quite pro-monarchy lawmakers who typically have, you know, come from, you know, a political, an elite political background. So in the case of a young man named Mohammed Dalain, a 23-year-old who carried out a suicide bombing in August for the extremist group ISIS, he was a medical student who was studying in the Ukraine, whose father is a sitting MP. And again, this family didn't have any real, you know, obvious economic problems. It seems that there was a big social problem between perhaps him and his family. So the case of Mr. Dalain has really forced people to rethink the sort of conventional wisdom on who ends up joining terrorist groups and why.
Yeah, I mean, this family also didn't really get any clues to their son's radicalization until very late in the game.
Exactly. I mean, just this past January, the young man had participated in an anti-ISIS march in Jordan. And then 9 months later, he had joined the group and had already, you know, committed to blowing himself up in a suicide bombing. You know, the family says that they suspect his radicalization happened while, you know, studying in the Ukraine, where he came into contact with people from Tunisia and elsewhere who were also in the country, who perhaps radicalized him. But again, like you said, there wasn't any real slow ascent towards his radicalization. It just seemed to happen very quickly.
Tamer El-Ghobashi with The Wall Street Journal speaking with me from Cairo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A little heads up as we end the program today. Starting next Monday, Carol Hills will be in the host chair for a bit while I head off to Kenya, all part of our Across Women's Lives project, a year-long take on women making a difference around the globe. Back in September, the team and I told you stories about women's justice in India. With the Kenya trip, we'll be looking at women owning it, as in women who run enterprises and businesses, big and small. What's interesting is how the money these women are earning is making a difference in the lives of other women and girls, not to mention men. In a week, I'll be coming to you from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, with the stories of some of the people we meet. We've already been talking a lot on social media about our plans, and there's a video on Facebook. You can find that at facebook.com/PRI the world. The video features a great track by a Kenyan rapper named Stella Mwangi. That's Stella Mwangi on the mic, making much noise, as you can hear. Stella's with us. You are, in fact, Kenyan-Norwegian, Stella, and you've got this track called Biashara. We chose it for some obvious reasons. Tell us what Biashara means.
Yeah, well, Biashara means actually business. That's what it means. You know, we have over 40 tribes in Kenya. So the word Biashara now is Kikuyu from my tribe. And it basically means, you know, the art of negotiating. You know, the inspiration behind it was that I found out that my business is my talent. And I just wanted to get that message out there.
You say business is the art of negotiation. What would you say about negotiation and becoming a successful businesswoman?
Well, you know, I am a music artist and I get booked for shows. What I've been finding quite hard, you know, throughout the years is actually saying what I'm worth, you know, because when I have my performances, that's how I earn my money. And when I come on stage, I entertain, I give my all. We all have something, and that is our business. Like, no one is born without business. All from the ugliest, you know, insects to the most beautiful flowers, they are like that because they are meant for that, because those insects can only see that type of flower, and that flower is like that to attract that insect. So you have something, and you need to realize that, and don't let the world define you and you know, what you're capable of.
Wow, what a great launchpad, Stella, for our team's travels to Kenya.
Yes.
Stella Mwangi, you're in Norway, I know, not in Nairobi, so perhaps someday we'll meet in person. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to see Stella singing Biashara in our video, it's up now at PRI.org. Our own theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you in a few days. President Moi kibaki wana hola naonesha kidole pole tubo tubo kubwa kama Rick Ross pesa zetu munafanyia what kazi kwa vijana pesa kwa maboss wacha kuwa floss ati wasanii watagi PRI Public Radio International.